Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million...
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had
Long Hope Bay Stacks and Jacks, I'm Tamal. We got Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 20. NASDAQ Futures up 185. So we're off to the races here this morning. Yesterday, we were a little bit the other. We were up 34 in the S&P. NASDAQ up 100. So we've had two decent days. Well, hopefully today will be a decent day in a row. We had a little bit of a top on the silver yesterday. Traded like 105 and came flying back down a little bit. Only finished up $5 when it was up 13 at one point. Now it's down 3 today, so maybe we've seen a top there. We will see on that. Do we have Professor Carl?
You do, you do.
How are you, bud?
Well, I'll tell you, I saw a very interesting correlation yesterday that I'm... You got to be careful with market correlations and ascribing more to them than there really is there, okay? Because it's really easy for people to do that, and I've done it, and I've been wrong about it too. But this one looks pretty solid. So you know, the whole gold silver thing. The obvious question is, you know, why, right? You know, why the monster spikes? Why the parabolic moves in these? Specifically in these two things. I mean, we know why you got one in natural gas, which has come off a little bit this morning. I mean, that's, you know, cold weather. It has this way of happening, right? but the interesting thing is, overlay that with Bitcoin.
Well, I actually was going to go right there when you were done talking. I said, what about gold and silver seem to have... I use the term, have taken their traditional place instead of Bitcoin right now for some reason.
Well, it seems to me that an awful lot of people have ditched. I mean, you know, if price is truth, and price tells you what the balance between buyers and sellers looks like, right? I mean, if that's the basic thing you operate on, boy, there's. You know, just overlay those two on a chart. That's is that the entire answer? Well, maybe. If it ends up being the case, though, it really puts the lie to a lot of ideas that people have. Of course, they'll never admit it because that would detonate their, you know, their what's left of their puny little brain. That either of these metals have anything to do with quote unquote money. Or Bitcoin does, for that matter. you know, it's one of the things I think is so interesting is that you've got, you know, unlike, well, I guess not so much unlike Bitcoin, but so many people, when they transact gold and silver, they don't do it in ETFs. They, you know, they go into a coin shop or whatever, right? If you go do that, you're going to find out that the spread between the spot price and you know, and your buy sell transaction is like ends up being like 20%.
You know, I've had a couple of people that have done that recently, Carol, and I thought for sure, to be honest with you, that it was, I don't want to agree with you, I thought it'd be 20% or more. And some people have told me they've offered like their really good, you know, sterling, like, you know, dipping spoons and stuff, and they get pretty close. And one of my cousins tells me he's got tells he got like 5 or 10 Krugerrands. He said they're spot.
But well, it's a rather, you know, it's kind of interesting because, well, spot in which direction, though? I mean,
well, I'm saying he said the Krugerrand is almost list price, is there something about the Krugerrand itself that causes it to be pretty close, or what?
I don't know. I mean, Krugerrands are kind of weird.
Okay. Well, they contain an ounce of gold, right?
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, normally with uncirculated coins, assuming you have them, you know, in a wrapper, you know, a proof set or whatever, there's a decent amount of numismatic value in there too. And of course, the problem with that is liquidity. There ain't none for the most part.
Yeah.
But that's always one of the things that I think is fascinating, because there's a decent percentage of metalheads on my forum. Right? There always have been. All the way back to 07 when I started it. And,
They had a lot of lean years. I know, because I was long stuff for a while.
Well, yeah. You know, I love the shiny. You know, it's the...
You watched Bitcoin go from, which is worth essentially nothing, go from zero to God knows what. You look at it and you go, what's going on here?
What the hell am I doing? Right. Yeah, exactly. It makes you question a lot of your premise, doesn't it? This latest thing, I think it's fascinating, because it appears that what you have here is a rotation out of the cryptocurrencies and into metals, which to me doesn't make a lot of sense. Because the concept now it does if you're simply looking at them both as assets of some kind, right? Okay, but if you're trying to think of them as people try to promote them as, which is basically the dollar is dying, neither one of them is where that will end, and so assuming you're right, neither one of them is going to be what replaces either, and if you really believe that you're going to get away with that sort of BS, just look at what happened to people that held gold during the Depression, and if you didn't turn it over as the government demanded, you still had it, but you couldn't spend it until 1970 something. So, gee, that does you a lot of good. You're probably dead by then, jackass.
Well, Kyle, you're probably my closest guy, the closest guy to somewhat of a currency monetary theorist. Okay.
Yeah.
But still, even you, and I'm going to say even me, in general conversation, we lose track of the obvious, because we still think that the dollar in our pocket is somehow a storehouse of value.
Oh, no. No, I don't.
I know if I ask you, you don't. But in conversation, you do, and so do I.
Well, no, I look at
it. Because it's been that way, like, forever. Here's what I think is somewhat going on. I'm going to kick me from a distance. The Bitcoin blew up to $3 trillion worth of value.
Right.
And it basically crapped a trillion of that. And it's been hanging in here at two-thirds of the upper value, right?
Right.
So now it's whatever's around is worth $2 trillion. Some of the other ones, the little ones, have lost even more, right? So... now we have this continuing devaluation of the dollar, not in terms of the pound or the other stuff, actually a little bit in terms of those, but clearly in terms of your car, in terms of, gas, maybe not so much gasoline, because that's come down, but it deteriorated against everything. So we continue to get this. how does somebody maintain that value somehow?
That's always the problem.
But
right?
it's not gold going up. It's people's perception of the dollar going down.
Well, but it's perception, okay? Because certainly if you take a look at a 1 year chart, for example, with silver, okay, SLV, just to be easy about it. You pull up a one year daily, the dollar has not lost two-thirds of its value in 1 year. Okay, in denominated in anything, in houses.
All right, I agree.
In automobiles, in natural, well, maybe natural gas, but that's temporary. This too shall pass when it warms up a little bit. But that's the thing, is that these kinds, it's one thing when you have a reasonably inverted connection. If gold goes up 7% and the federal deficit is 6.5 or 8, okay, I'll buy, I mean, at least mechanistically and mathematically, I'll buy this. I mean, that may or may not be the reason, but I can at least defend it from a standpoint of saying, well, yeah, the two have an inverse relationship and they're pretty well correlated. That, you know, all right, fine. That's just not the case here.
Well, but, don't read more to it than it is. I mean, look at, for instance, your General Motors came out with a good earnings today. But I do have a little weirdo hobby. I do kind of for myself just to keep track. There's always guys in the building buying and selling old trucks, right?
Right.
So I constantly am looking to see what. Plus, I bought mine 2 years ago, and I'll tell everybody I paid $10.5 for it.
Okay. Right?
And I'm going to say I cannot duplicate it now. Now, is it worth more than it was a year ago? Hell no. It's got a little rust, but it didn't have then.
It's got more miles. Yeah.
It's got more miles. I mean, I actually, in some ways, it's better because I fixed it up some. But,
well, yeah.
But the fact is, I can't touch it for 15 now.
Right, right.
Now, do I think that the truck is increased in, quote, value? No, I'm not that stupid.
No.
So, but the thing that I'm valuing it with would be the dollar. And it's not just the dollar. It's the fact that nobody can buy a new one. The demand for the old ones is bigger because anything that runs is worth. Anything that doesn't run is worth like $6,000, for God's sake, it seems.
Yeah.
So we have all kinds of things that are impacting things here. And then when you get a trade, I mean, there's only so much gold and silver around. All of a sudden, everybody wants to be in there. Everybody runs in. Then all of a sudden, you got margin increases.
Right.
You squeeze the hell out of the stuff. Pretty soon, it's up here. As a matter of fact,
there was a debate about this stuff. You know, during the time of the crash in the 07-08 time frame, there was a very large debate about allowing people without a end use interest of some kind in the commodity markets. Okay, I don't know if you remember this, but it's
always been they call them speculators even though they're market makers.
Well, it happens every time there's a dislocation in price. Okay, you know, in any of these things.
Well, in somebody's opinion.
well, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
All right, and you know, as I've said, and as Hal's said, and you know, I know Hal's listening because I can see him pop. You know, he's up here, even though his mic's not on. You know, the cure for high prices is frequently thought of as high prices, right? So, but it, you know, one of the things that's kind of interesting is that if you remember during the pandemic in the middle of the crazy. You could get your common ordinary spool of Romex house wire, all right? But all of a sudden, all the home stores, the Lowe's, the Home Depot's, the, you know, the 84 Lumber's, all these guys, all of a sudden, all this, every one of these guys stuck all this stuff behind locked cages. And the reason they were doing it is people stealing it.
Oh, right? Sure.
In mass. Yeah. They were stealing it in size. And if you think about the craziness of this, a roll of 14-2, okay, absolutely bog standard stuff that's in 90% of the houses in America, all right, has for quite a long time been about $100. All right, it's been about, you know, about a hundo, roughly. All of a sudden, it's 300.
Well, that's because you guys in these
states
that you can use that stuff.
But I'm saying Chicago is Mr. Conduit City, right? Where you have to run THHN and pipe.
Which makes it a hell of a lot easier if they rewire a whole house.
Well, if there's ever a problem, it's a hell of a lot easier to deal with the THHN than it is with Romex.
Oh, yeah.
Like ridiculously easier. You know, because you don't have to rip walls open because the stuff's stapled to the studs. But the thing that is that I thought fascinating about this at the time was that I'm looking at the copper futures price, and yeah, it's up, but not like that, right? And normally, when you see that kind of a dislocation, you're like, hey, wait a minute, maybe there's an arbitrage trade here, and I, you know, that's how I think because I'm a trader, right?
Well, if it's up a buck a pound, and you're talking about something that weighs 15 pounds, it's $15, not 100.
Right, exactly, and it's like, so I'm looking at this saying, hey, wait a minute, maybe I got an arbitrage trade I can put out here, you know, maybe, you know, make a little money. Well, as it turns out, the reason, and then this went on for a while after most of the silliness was over. Then all of a sudden, one day I'm in Lowe's and I go by the cage and that same rolls back to $100. Okay. And I'm like, okay. So digging into the reason for the spike, what I finally found...
Oh, it could be umbrellas in the rain.
No, it wasn't the copper, Chief. What it was that there was a supply chain problem with one of the precursor chemicals that goes into the plastic jacket that's on the conductors. And so there was plenty of copper, but you couldn't make the cable because you couldn't make the jacket.
Well, and your Lowe's and your Home Depot, they would never do something like this. If all of a sudden they've got 50 of them in the store and they're starting to sell 10 a day and they can't get any more, guess what? They're going to run the price up, but the ones they have left.
Well,
duh.
Yeah, duh. Right. So, I mean, but this was, you know, I just thought it was fascinating because it was, even though it looked like it was a copper problem, it wasn't. Okay, it was actually...
Oh, we couldn't possibly have any fake news.
Well, but it wasn't a copper problem.
Right.
You know, yeah. So, I mean, this is, and what I, one of the things that was a marker in the early part of 2007 and into the summer, you know, when we had those two hedge funds that blew up and you know, would put the antenna up on my, you know, on the back of my head was in the spring of 07, just before earnings season, you had this huge dislocation in the overseas markets in Asia. Right? And it was one of those deals where you wake up one morning, you look at it and the Shanghai's down 8% or something like this, right? It's like, what the hell happened over there? I mean, was there a nuclear... Did somebody, you know, start a nuclear war and didn't bother to tell me? You know? I mean, it was that kind of an event.
Trust
right?
me, you'd be the last to know, they say.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, but I didn't see the flash off to the east or to the west, depending on which way you look, right? Halfway around the other side of the world. And so... Yeah, I start digging into it, and I find all this stuff, these shenanigans that are going on with paying dividends in the financials out of capitalized interest and stuff like this. And that's, you know, you start writing about it. But one of the other things that happens at the end of this, and it happened in 1999 and into the first couple months of 2002, is these kinds of crazy rotations, where and you've seen some of this in other areas as well. For example, the Russell. If you look at the Russell and its movements compared with the S&P and the Nasdaq, for example, you'll see quite an interesting difference between those two. All right, and that to me, I think is quite telling, because here we are with there's two things and they ain't the same, right?
Well, that's and, you know. Can we wrap back a little bit? When Carl was talking about the commodity side, which the gold and stuff is, when you have a commodity market, and boy, I was talking to Jan Flanagan was on yesterday talking about the I&M Canal and the opening of the Board of Trade, and
yeah,
when you have, let's take something real simple, so I can be real brief with it. If you have a market in, say, corn, which we of course do. Now, why is our market in corn? Well, because Kellogg's, that makes cornflakes, doesn't really want to be a speculator. They want to be able to purchase corn futures out in advance so they know how to price their product. They know where they're going.
They want to know what the cost of the corn will be in 2 years.
Or 18 months or 12 months or whatever.
Next year, yeah.
Next crop, usually. But
right, well, they want to know when they're making the boxes and cranking up the line, they want to have a decent idea of what it's going to cost them to put the stuff in the box.
Right. So the farmer, yeah, on the other hand, sits there and goes, okay, I got all my stuff in the ground. Looks like it cost me $2 to get in the ground. The futures are trading $3. I'll take a buck on half of it.
That's a dollar, right.
Yeah, and or he probably won't take all of it because he might get a hailstorm over his farm. That's a problem.
Right.
So the idea is he'll take some percentage of it. Some guys, if they've never had a problem, might do all of it. You know, who knows? But, I mean, that's up to the guy. But... those are they're natural hedgers, is what they're called. They're called hedgers. Now, the people in the middle, what makes you think the farmer's going to show up to sell the same day Kellogg's goes up to buy? Well, you need market makers that will make a market essentially every minute of the day. And there's people who just make the market. I'm a quarter bid at a half, quarter bid at a half. And that's what they do. Then there's people who are actually speculating. Well, I think this corn's going up, or I read something about the Chinese are buying soybeans. I'm buying soybeans. then those are called speculators. But really, anybody who's not a natural hedger is called is considered a speculator, whether you're just a plain old market maker going flat every day or whether you actually do take positions. And every once in a while, people turn around and blame the speculators, which can happen because you're probably not going to see, you know, Kellogg's run the price of corn up to $12. They'll say, I'll take my chances.
Right.
But and you're probably not going to see the farmer, you know, sell it down to $1.50 below where he put it in there. But he could, I mean, depending on how bad it is. But that's not – so there's always every once in a while people rear up and say, who are these guys, right?
Right.
Now, the question is, who's buying all the gold? Are there people that short it at a certain price? Say, but the silver is more of a phenomenon than gold. I mean, yes – I mean, I've been along this stuff for, you know, years for clients. A lot of clients have wanted a little bit in their portfolio for – I'm talking 5, 6, 7 years. They never moved anywhere. We made a few bucks on the – you know, maybe with the puts. When it ran up and down, we scalped the puts a little bit, but not
– right.
And we sold a few calls, but I'm going to say it's been a – nothing compared to the market, making 10, 15, 20% a year. I mean,
that's the point, Chief, that I've always made to people is that if you think that this is a great inflation hedge in the general sense, you take the year, you know, you take when gold came off of, when it was actually became tradable, okay, by ordinary people, getting back in the 1970s, and you take $100, you put it in gold, you take another $100, you put it into the S&P 500 or the Dow, all right, either one, you know, pick one, right? And tell me where you would have had more money at, you know, pretty much anywhere down the road, right? Now, not the ups and downs, but, you know, over time, right? Which one was actually the better inflationary hedge? And the answer is always common stocks.
Well, except for the last few months.
Well,
all of a sudden
I get that. Okay, all of a sudden you've got this huge spike, and it's like, okay, you know, the market's up, you know, 8% or whatever over the last year, or 10 or 11 or whatever it is, and you know, and silver's tripled.
Well, I mean, I remember having this conversation when we started getting some. This was a lot of clients. Okay, so, and I'm not talking about people that are 25 years old. A lot of my clients are retired, yeah. And you know, when all of a sudden your treasuries went from making 1% up to like 5 or 5.5.
Right.
And, you know, guys would be saying, well, I think maybe this is, you know, I listen more than I, believe it or not, I listen more than I talk to clients. And they say, I'm not really want to be in, you know, now that I'm not working anymore, I'm going to be this much in the market, and we'll put some in treasuries that, you know, we were getting, at that point, we're getting 5, 5.5 on the 90 days. So we're going to the auction every week for people.
Right.
And a lot of people basically split it in half, put half in the metals and half in the treasuries.
Right.
So the last 6 months, I mean, we've made wildest dreams money in the gold and silver.
Oh, yeah, and by the way...
We've been dragging some puts, so we weren't just naked long, so that's...
But, Chief, if you knew that was going to happen, you would have all been in silver.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Well, Chief, you must have done great for these guys. If I was that good, I would have said, to hell with the treasury.
With the treasuries, exactly.
You know, but the fact is, nobody's that good. The only difference is I admit it.
Yeah. No, I get that, and it's like, you know, as I've pointed out to people many times, you're only as good as your last trade, right?
Well, yeah.
And eventually, you know, I mean, I don't know if that little thing that happened yesterday. By the way, that spike up and then back down was on huge volume too. Okay.
Well, I was a little bit involved in that. The thing is, the silver's up $12, and there's an expiration, and there's an expiration today. Actually, the expiration was yesterday. And so things trading like 105, and 100 puts are 20 cents. And I go, you know, first of all, I don't really speculate for my people. But then I'm sitting there going, you know, this is like crazy too high here. I'll just buy, you know, whatever. I'll just buy, if a guy's got 100 shares of silver, which is worth, you know, whatever, 10 grand, I'm going to buy, you know, 10 of these things.
Right.
And actually, I bought one for 100 shares. So I buy them at 21 cents, 30, 40, 50. They go to like $1.50. I try and sell the ones 3 strikes under for double what I paid for those. And, of course, the thing turns around in a nanosecond, we don't get it. It's like, all right, sweet.
Right.
We've had our fun. You know, they're going to expire in 2 hours.
Take the money.
We took 58 cents or something. So we paid 21, sold 58. You know, not the best, but better than a sharp stick in the eye, and on something, you know, that's going to, expire in a little bit. All of a sudden, they go to $3, and I'm going, "What is
what?
The what is the matter with you? Why didn't you get out downstairs and have a beer or something?" But you know that happens. Then they came back again to like 60 cents and went back up to $3 and closed at 1.25. You know, but that's what happens, and that's why you get, you know, any profit's a good profit when you're close to expiration like that. But I mean, if you ask me, hey, Chief, would you normally buy a $5 out of the money put with 3 hours left to go?
Hours left in the day.
I said, no, you're out of your friggin' mind. Yesterday, the volatility was 130 on the calls of puts yesterday. Make that 170.
I just, you know, stuff like this, when I see that sort of, I guess the point I'm trying to make is when I see that kind of price action, and I see that kind of rotational thing, what it tells me, above everything else, is that the instability in the system is extremely high. It doesn't tell me which way things are going to break, but it tells me something's going to break. But it doesn't tell me where. And so, you know, I mean, but it is a warning, and one that I think anybody that's in the market right now ought to be paying attention to, that we are, you know, this, then you take the geopolitical situation, you take the domestic political situation that we have going on right now.
Oh, God, yeah.
You take all those things and add them up, and I think that the probability, you know, on any random day, there is some probability that the market's going to crash, right? You're going to have a Black Friday, October surprise kind of problem, right? On any random day.
Well, one thing you know for sure is if it happens, the Fed's going to pour money into it. Well, the question is it going to be enough if it really happens?
Well, and you know what? In 2000, 2008, they did that. It didn't stop it, okay? And in 2000, it was, you know, 3-4 years before it came back. You know, 8, you know,
2000.
Okay,
why don't you make that? Why don't you, for those stocks, try 2 decades.
Oh, no. Well, if you were in the wrong places, it was, for all intents and purposes, infinite because a lot of them went to zero. All right.
Well, the only one of the top, the only ones of the top 7, or the top 5 at the time, that are up, and they weren't up for a decade, is Microsoft.
Well, yeah.
Cisco's still kind of where it was. Oracle.
Well, even Cisco got hammered. Yo, yeah, I mean, you know, these we're not talking about schlock little outfits that had
Cisco
no
went from 66 to 6.
And
I bet it didn't cross. I bet it didn't cross 66 until last year.
Yeah, if you were in one of those, you got it in the back door.
Well, Intel's not doing so. They're still not back to where they were.
Well, but now Intel is another darling again. You know, all of a sudden
they got their ass kicked this week. Huge.
Well, yeah, they did. So, you know, anyway,
what is the story with this? Okay, we got Joel. I'll ask Joel that. I don't know if he'll be back. I think we probably have Kenny today. Okay. If not, we'll talk to you on Friday. Yeah, we had so many topics, it's unbelievable. Let's head to Joel. Joel, how are you?
Good morning, Chief. How are things in the Windy City?
Cold. We're not going to see freezing until above freezing for like another 2 weeks.
Oh man, I can remember those days near Lakeshore Drive and just that wind and boy, that's cold.
Well, it reaches the point now. If you walk outside, even though it's 5 degrees, if it's not windy, it feels warm.
I know. Yeah. Can you imagine that? Getting that kind of mentality, but what? It's here.
How did you guys dodge the snow and the cold?
We did. It just things swept down to the south and then came up on the eastern seaboard and the Weather Channel. I don't know what they're doing over there, but
we had a little bit of lake effect that hit us a little bit.
Yeah. Yep, and we were in. I mean, we still getting the cold, still getting the snow, and like the snow, it's icy snow. You know, you get the snow, and then it gets warmer a little bit, and then so I was out there shoveling my front yard there for the dog to find some grass out there.
We have zero ice.
Zero?
Yep, it's never been warm enough for the snow to melt to make ice.
Yeah. Well, we get a little sunlight or whatever, but what do you want, Chief? What do you want to talk about?
We have crazy stuff going on. Well, we've got United Health down 15%. We've got By the way, did you do the next time on your show, I'm going to ask how many times you guys did the greatest pairs trade in the history of the world. Buy Micron, sell Oracle. 100 shares, would you be up 45 grand now?
Yeah, well, Micron's due to report, so...
They're up 16, they're up 17
no,
bucks
no,
today.
No, I don't think so. But I think they're a little bit later in the cycle. Yeah, Oracle disaster, poster child for the overspend in the AI trade. I tried to pick up a little bit at the end of the year and had a little bit of daylight on it. You got the death cross with the 50 and the 200 moving over. I mean, it's trading now lower, much lower than it was before it had the deals. So right there, there's the poster child for the AI overspend.
And then they had the whole idea they were going to get the big deal with TikTok, and they did get that, and it's 30 bucks below when they got the deal.
It's one of the most hated stocks on Wall Street. There's just no other way around it, Chief.
Well, how did they go from September at 325, make that 922, the most loved stock in the world? How do you go from there to we're talking 140 bucks in 3 months? How do you go? You couldn't go from that kind of love to hate. A girlfriend couldn't if you dump her. I mean, that's the quickest love hate I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's debt. You know, they're worried about the debt to do these deals. And if these deals are, you know, I mean, they're heavily dependent on, you know, OpenAI for a lot of these contracts. And they just don't know if they have the money, even when they get little spurts that, you know, they are getting more engagement. But the other thing I think that's overhanging Oracle is, you know, Larry Ellison and, you know, getting involved in this Warner Brothers, Netflix saga, you know, willing to put up several billion dollars for that. So just momentum out of the stock. This is a momentum market. When you lose your momentum, you see what happens.
Well, it's one of these days, if the world ever quiets down, maybe we could actually have a few shows where we talked about, you know, maybe what's wrong or right with corporate governance. I mean, Larry Ellison, do you think it's his company as far as he's concerned? Of course, he still owns a lot of stock, but if he wants to buy another company at $30 billion, he doesn't ask anybody. I mean, that's part of, if your guy's the Messiah, I guess it's okay, but one day they stop being that, and I mean, does the board do anything? Do they ever give a dividend? Do they ever spread some of this money around, or do they just look for their next, you know, mental feeding frenzy? I mean, you wonder, how are these places governed? I mean, who governs Tesla? Who governs any of these Meta? Who governs any of these places? I mean, it's a case now. We have so much other else to talk about, but at some point, why aren't those people? Why aren't they still private? Why do they go get other people's money and then use it like it's their own? As long as they're making money, nobody cares, right?
Because they can.
Yeah, because they can. I mean, does anybody think when you pick your own board, what's the point, eh?
That's correct.
But so what do you make of what's going on down? Did you happen to listen in? It's a long conversation, but Lou talking last week about the guy, the NIL guy from Duke, is they got a court injunction, now he can't leave.
Yeah, that's getting so messy. I mean, the Oregon guy, he left, he's coming back. There's clearly no governance on this. And there's no boundaries that have been set, and so it's chaotic. It's happened at more than one school where you've had this kind of. So there was a I read about Mississippi supposedly tampering with a Clemson player that was already enrolled in class, and they're texting him and offering him another $1 million, another contract. There's just no way. There's just no way that it can continue in this fashion. But there's going to be problems. And
it sounds like regular business to me.
Yeah, a business with their own rules. Yeah,
well, there are some rules, but I mean, it's not like somebody doesn't quit and go to work for another accounting firm, and 6 months later they go get the guy back, right?
True.
We're so locked into this you know, the we're so locked into the monopolies of baseball is somewhat a legit one, and NFL acts like they are, and so does the NBA, even though they're not. And they get away with it. So does anybody think that we need to have a draft of high school players now or something? I mean, it's crazy. I'll bet there's people who think so.
You don't need no draft when you've got the money.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, you can look at it, you know, from the other side. I mean, it's still a major conference, but, you know, the grip of, you know, the Alabama, Ohio State, you know, Indiana, you know, coming in and winning the national championship. I mean, that, it shows that, you know, there's hope. There's hope anywhere. If any Indiana can pull out a game or pull out a national championship, I mean, you really got to give it to, you know, that Kurt Cignetti. I mean, the, you know, that quarterback, Mendoza, I mean, he couldn't get a scholarship. He was going to go to Yale, then he got offered by Cal and was the third string quarterback there. So a lot has to say with the coaching, too. And now you got Mark Cuban bankrolling them, and, they're their co-favorite to win the national championship next year with Ohio State.
Well, what does it say when the average age of the team is 24?
It says that they got a lot of transfers coming in, a lot of older players, and that is the new trend that you're going to be seeing.
Well, I think you're going to end up with anybody who's in school gets to play.
Yeah, I saw that Miami has a guy coming back for his eighth year.
How does that work? Is that still a COVID year in there?
I have quite a few COVID years and red shirt years and stuff, but in eighth year for him, Chief.
Well, you know, actually, again, this is a bizarre. If somebody went 4 years and is 3 years in law school and he's in quote college, I don't see why the guy can't play. But I don't think the academics are driving these guys, is it?
No, Chief, and that's certainly a statement that we've been making, you know, recently. But
well, it could be. It could be for some guys.
Well, if you're saying if this guy's getting an eighth year, he might be a doctor by now.
Well, that's right. You know, it's even weirder is the NFL still looks about all this as now we're getting even more mature player. They're going to find out that these guys are really a competitor of theirs. That somebody's going to play 7 years, even though he could probably play pro ball. He's going to say, I made $2 million a year. I'm now a lawyer. See ya.
I'll tell you, these kids, I mean, you know, also for the NBA, we don't have time to go into it. But, hey, you want to be a bench warmer or a two-way player in the NBA or make a couple $1 million, you know, staying a fifth and sixth year in college. I mean,
maybe then the schedule's easier. You're going to school. God knows what you do on your off hours. It's a lot easier life.
It is. So, big game, Chief. I got to hop. All right. Big game tonight. The undefeated Nebraska Cornhuskers are coming to Chrysler Arena.
Wow.
Believe it or not, they're ranked seventh. We're ranked third. We're 10.5-point favorites. That makes me a little bit uneasy.
Is this on a real channel that I can watch it?
I don't know. I'll be in my cozy seats watching it. So
oh, you're at the game. Oh, good for you. Good for you.
Yep. Yeah, I got. And then Saturday, we have our cross-state rival, our in-state rival, Michigan State. They're ranked seventh. That's the highest the two teams have ever been ranked when they've played. So.
Well, hopefully it's not in the Big Ten. I can actually. Kevin says the Miami guy has his standard red shirt year. His COVID year and two separate injury years. Jesus.
Yeah. Okay, Chief, right, I got to hop. I'll talk to you on Thursday.
Do we have Professor Kenny?
We do.
How are you? We announced you're a professor now.
I am freezing my ass off here in New York City. Oh, my God. It's so cold outside. I can't stand it.
Well, that's because you've been in Florida thinning your Italian blood. What can I tell you?
Yeah, I know. Isn't that the truth? Here I am sitting on the corner of Lexington Avenue and 53rd Street in a coffee shop waiting to have this conversation with you on my way down to the New York Stock Exchange. But I had to get over here by the subway so I could jump off with you and get right on the subway to get to downtown. So what's going on?
Well, you tell me everything. Hey, yeah. What do you make of this? I mean, we're talking about People are, I mean, boy, talk about the untruths flying around. We didn't get a chance. I haven't talked about it with anybody yet, but I'll just run this one by you. You see this study out of these guys in a worldwide study that 96% of the tariffs are being absorbed by people here and not overseas.
Yeah, well,
when you and I have known that, but I mean, most of the people are absolutely convinced that they still listen to God knows who, and that other people are paying it. No, they're not.
Yeah, no, that was, but we knew that, right? The tariffs were going to affect us. We were the ones that were going to end up paying the higher prices, but we would only pay the higher prices if we chose to buy those products that were getting marked up. Now, some of it you have to buy, but other stuff you don't have to buy, so therefore you can make a decision, right, whether or not you want to pay the higher price or not. But one way or the other, yes, I think it's always been known that we were going to be the ones to pay that tax or tariff, however you want to call it. One way or the other, though, it hasn't seemed to slow down, you know, the economic data, the economy, the consumer, even consumer sentiment is trending higher. While it's still low in the 50s, it trended, you know, it was expected to be 54, came to 56. So it's trending higher, which suggests that the consumer's feeling okay. So it's hard to argue, because look at all the other economic data that's coming out. Everything is pointing to an economy that remains fairly robust. Unemployment's at 4.4%, which is considered full employment. And so, yes, we can argue all we want about the tariffs, but it has not brought the economy to a standstill the way that so many people thought it was going to.
Well, I think you, when I used to do, believe it or not, Kenny, I was in a class and we did a lot of work on tariffs. And then the fly in the ointment is always how much the domestic people are going to raise their prices because now the other guys are higher. And that's the part that nobody necessarily sees. So you know, part of the reason that General Motors just had a nice quarter is because their prices are probably higher than they would be if other people didn't have tariffs.
I agree with you.
Autos
have gone crazy.
That's never really mentioned. Well, plus he's got...
because it doesn't fit the narrative, right?
Well, I know, but... well, yeah. And the... it says here, this is this... Who are these guys? Kiel Institute? You know these guys?
No.
U.S. Customs revenue increased by approximately $200 billion in 2025. Foreign exporters absorbed only about 4%. The tariff burden, 96% passed through to U.S. buyers. Trade volumes collapsed, but export prices did not fall. So they're saying that the it's being absorbed here, and the smaller the manufacturer, the worse it is on them. Which I think perhaps you and I probably could have guessed. I mean, this whole idea, all the policies that you can sort of deduce coming out of this administration, and all the narrative being we're pushing, you know, the American manufacturer. I think the smaller manufacturer is getting beaten every which way you can here. I mean, by not being able to borrow money, tariffs, everything. I mean, it may benefit some of the really bigger people, but it's sure as hell not. But the same people that everybody keeps saying are the ones we want to get going, I don't think they're being helped at all.
What, the U.S., the small U.S. manufacturer?
Yeah.
Why is the smallest U.S., are you saying the small U.S. manufacturer is getting hurt because of the product that they have to import in order to manufacture?
Yeah.
You know, that's an interesting concept. You're right. No one's really talking about that. I can't speak to it because I'm also not aware, although I haven't heard the small manufacturers stand up screaming and yelling. I've heard the small manufacturers saying that, you know, that they're okay. I haven't heard them under pressure, but maybe I'm not listening at the right places.
Well, that's the thing. Wherever you listen, though, you sure as hell get different stories, don't you?
Right.
I mean, I think part of it being Hal's been doing a lot of work on the difference in how much people have to pay for money once you get past the big guys, and it's, you know, he's almost at a point where it was done on purpose to put these people out of business. He's going back on.
But you know what? I think that's always been, listen, if you're somebody who's got money, the cost of money is always cheaper for you versus the guy either that doesn't or has little, right? That's always been the case. So I think it might have gotten more dramatic certainly over the last number of years. But I don't think that's a new story. I think it's always the same story. People with money, it's easy to get money.
Well, it becomes a matter of degree. I mean, God, I remember back in the day when if you were like Johnson & Johnson, you borrowed at prime, right? And, yep. if you were somebody else, Pullman was, I think, even though they had never not paid anybody, they were like half over prime or something.
Right.
And somebody else would be three quarters over, and somebody might be 2 points over. And even your junk bonds were like, when prime was six, they were like 11. And they were supposedly junk. And,
yeah.
And you know, but I mean, now I'm not so sure, you know, what does a plumber pay for his fifth truck? I mean, with the Dodd-Frank, who has to sign it? The personal guarantees and all other stuff that go, even though you're a corporation, it's becoming, it's a lot more difficult.
Yeah, yeah. My guess is that the plumber's paying a lot more per his truck. I will say, because I think auto and truck prices have just gone through the roof.
I'm talking about interest rates on going to the bank and saying, because I know guys who are in the housing business, when they got to their fifth or sixth house, they had, you know, an up and running company, and they said, okay, we need to borrow some money. Here's our collateral. The other five houses, oh no, that's no good. Plus, we need the deed to your house too, you know, which didn't go over too well with the wife,
right?
Shall we say? So, what's up on your end? Would you really?
So,
go ahead.
No, so I've been traveling a little bit. I'm in New York City this whole week. I'm on my way down to the Exchange now because I'll go on Schwab TV at 9:30, so I want to get down there ahead of time. But listen, it's we're right in the thick of it, right? This week is a big week. We're going to have 100 plus companies that are reporting. We already got UNH and General Motors this morning. Now I see UNH is getting clocked. I think there's some Medicare news out about, you know, Medicare payments didn't nearly increase as much as either the industry expected, so they're selling off all those names. Although UNH did come out with a fairly decent report, from what I understand. I have to read it. I'm just
watered down
what the headlines are. But
I got them down 56 bucks. Very, I don't know if you saw that. Yeah. Down 56. That's 16%. That's a lot.
Yeah, it's like It was when I left the apartment, it was down 12%. So it's gone down to 4% in the four blocks that I walked. But I think it's going to be interesting tonight after the bell. We're going to get the start of really the tech season. Now, you know, tomorrow and Thursday start Meta and Apple and Microsoft and Tesla. So big four names out of the Mag 7. But tonight you're going to get Seagate and Texan. And I think that's going to lay the groundwork for the broader tech, what we're going to hear out of the tech industry. Seagate, I think, is the one that I'm going to be paying the most attention to. Because they're all about memory, right? Seagate, Western Digital, and Micron, as you know, over the last 12 months have skyrocketed. I think Seagate's up 245% in the 12 months. It's up 30% this year alone. And what are we, 4 weeks into the year? And so I think Seagate's going to be very, very exciting tonight. I think a lot of people are going to be waiting to hear what they say about guidance, what they say about the AI spend. Is it going to be the same as what we heard from Taiwan Semi a couple of weeks ago, which was very bullish? And that's going to set the tone then, I think, for the ongoing tech trade, right? So I think that's what I'm looking at tonight is going to be those. I'm not, you know, okay, great, UNH and General Motors, and it's going to give you a broader sense of the broader economy, and that's important as well. But I think futures are still higher. I think Dow futures are getting crushed because of UNH. But I think the S&P and NASDAQ are still higher, aren't they?
That's 350 points in the Dow, one stock.
Yeah, right. But it's only one stock, correct. I mean, it's a big stock. UNH is a big stock, right?
The
Dow's a price-weighted.
But what's the multiplier? What's the multiplier,
index?
7?
I'd have to go back and look. I don't know.
I think it's like 6.8 or something, so it's like 7.
Yeah, it might be. But remember, the Dow's a price-weighted index, right? So it's going to be affected by high-priced stocks. UNH is a high-priced stock. But I don't think that, you know, Dow being down 250 or 300 points is indicative of the broader economy. I think it's very specifically UNH this morning. I don't think that's a statement on, you know, the rest of the Dow name or the broader economy. So I think you have to take that in stride. But one way or the other, I think, you know, my sense is that earnings are going to continue to be robust as expected. Look, they got GDP now expected to grow in the first quarter at 5%. There's certainly nothing wrong with that. I don't think it's going to, you know, it's not going to be 5% for the year, but this first quarter is going to be 5%, or at least they're looking at that. We saw the final third quarter was 4.5%, so that continues to be strong. So I'm bullish on the year. I'm bullish on earnings season. I do, though, think nobody should be surprised if we see that midterm year kind of pullback in the market, 12 to 14% at some point. I think it's going to happen in the first half of the year versus not. But I think that's going to be an opportunity. I don't think that's going to be a reason to panic at all. But I think you have to be strategic and selective when it happens.
I see the numbers you're talking about, and I see what some of the stuff Hal's doing, and I see some of the stuff I'm doing. With the policies, not just of this administration, it's going back really, I could say, till 2000. I don't know that you can possibly even have any idea of whether we're going forward or back with the numbers they put out. Because Hal's talking about an 11% possibly money supply growth over the next 18 months.
Yeah.
If that's the case, and you cheat on your deflator, you're always gonna have nothing but growth, nominal growth. But it won't be. Is it real growth? Is the question.
Well, I guess that's a question. But look, you and I can argue about that. We've had tremendous money supply growth for 18 years.
That's
now,
right.
Right.
That's right.
They started printing money back in 2007 or 8, when the crisis happened, and they continue to print it, and the economy continues to grow. The stock market continues to advance. And so, yes, I'm not suggesting that, you know, that it's right. I'm suggesting that they have to at some point get it under control. I just know how they're going to do that. I don't know how they're going to do that.
Well, it's real simple. You stop pouring it in.
You stop pouring it in, which is fine. And then you'll see a correction, which probably is going to be necessary. Right. But I don't think anyone really I don't think they want to see that. So now they're kind of stuck in this. What do we do? Right. Do we stop printing and see the market reprice and, you know, cause a lot of pain? They don't want to do that.
Well,
certainly,
I think
all the big guys don't want to see that happen, right?
Well, I think what's happened, unfortunately, and I will say unfortunately, is the Fed, they can say what they want about inflation and full employment, but right now it's maintaining the bubble. That's the job.
Yeah.
And that's a problem, because you wonder how long you can push that.
Well, if Stevie Mearing gets his way, he's going to continue to push it, right? He's looking for another, at some point, 100 basis points worth of cuts over this year, which I think is ridiculous. But if he gets his way, he'll do it. Now, I don't think it's going to happen, but he'll stamp his feet, you know, at every Fed meeting. I suspect tomorrow we're going to hear, you know, no rate cut, but we're going to hear Stevie Mearing being the lone dissenter. He wants a rate cut. But I don't think you're going to get one. I don't think you're actually going to get one until you get a new Fed chair. I think Jay Powell is going to send the message that, look, the economy's fine. The data does not demand that we cut rates, and we're not cutting them right now. And, you know, that'll piss Trump off, and he'll you know, piss and moan. But I think he'll just let it ride until May because then he'll make the announcement about who his new Fed chair is going to be, and then the market will start to adjust.
What makes you think that what if Powell doesn't quit?
I think Powell is going to quit. Here's what I think. I think Powell is so done with the bullshit. I think he's done with being attacked. I think he's done with being second-guessed. He's 70-something years old, or nearly 80 years old. I think he's just done. What? The guy's got plenty of money. He was a huge success at Carlyle Group and wherever else he worked. The guy's got tons of money. He doesn't need this. Why would anybody in their right mind want to stay on? I just don't get it. So in my mind, I don't see Powell staying on. What's he going to stay on just to piss everyone off? For what? It's ridiculous. It doesn't, to me, it doesn't make any sense. I guess it could happen, but it doesn't make any sense at all. But we'll see.
Well,
and look, if Trump picks Ricky Reeder, who, by the way, if you're noticing in the prediction markets, Ricky Reeder has advanced nicely over the last week. He's now a 51% chance of being named versus Kevin Warsh, who's dropped down to 29%. There's been a real shift in thinking there. And, you know me, you and I have talked about this. Ricky Reeder was my dark horse choice all along. Now he's starting to raise his head. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Now, is the guy going in there thinking he has any possibility of any kind of independence?
Well, you know, it's funny. We had this conversation yesterday about is the new Fed chair, does he have to do a wink, wink and promise to cut rates at least once just to pacify the crowd? Or can he go in there and say, look, I'm going to run it my way. And if we don't cut, we don't cut. And I don't know. That's an interesting question. I'd like to see that happen. I'd like to see somebody stand up and say, look, we're doing it the way I see it now that I'm Fed chair, period, the end. But can you really go in there and think it's going to be independent? I'd like to hope, because I'd like to think that the Fed is independent. I'd like to think that the Fed can remain independent. I think it's important that the Fed be independent.
Well, you have a
demand what rate should be.
We have a president that wants to run everything.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I hear you. And that's, you know, so he ends up being his own worst enemy. He doesn't know when to keep his, I hate to say it, he doesn't know when to keep his mouth shut. Right?
Right.
He just should just stop. That's what he should do. Anyway.
Well, are you going to be on the tube this morning?
I'm going to be on Schwab TV at 9:30, and then I'm going to be on Fox at 2 o'clock with Charles Payne.
Hey, good for you, bud. Anyway,
I'm on my way down into the subway now, so I'm going to lose you as I get down there.
Down into the subway. What was the song, Will He Never Return? Will he never... make sure you get out of the subway down at the other end.
I will say, the only way to get around Manhattan, especially now because there's snow everywhere and it's a disaster, is honestly the subway.
Without a doubt. All right, buddy.
You know what I mean?
Well, thanks for calling in, considering you're sitting there freezing. All right,
I'll see you next week.
Yes. Do we have Professor Hal?
What's up, Tom?
How are you, buddy? Everything's up.
Everything's
up. Pick a subject, for God's sake. What do you think it is?
Well, not everything's up. I was looking at Bitcoin versus the trends in gold and silver using Federal Reserve data. And it's kind of interesting. If you set both as an index to like May of 2024, they tracked together pretty well until August of last year. And then there's this huge... the trends just explode away from each other. Gold and silver is way up, as you know, and Bitcoin's way down. And, you know, all three are inflation hedges, but
I'm going to push back. I don't know what Bitcoin is. People say it's an artificial stock that's an inflation hedge.
Yeah, but it's an inflation hedge along with gold and silver, but gold and silver have industrial use. So yeah, I'm kind of thinking also, maybe in August of last year, people who own Bitcoin, not all of them, but people who own Bitcoin have seen a huge run-up in it, and maybe they felt like it's not going to continue, and they maybe needed some cash, but they didn't want to convert all of it to cash. So I think maybe what they did is they shifted it into gold and silver, because maybe there's this pent-up demand or this new demand for gold and silver in terms of industrial uses. And then I looked at the Fed's industrial index, and it is up 2% since the beginning of the last year. So maybe the move in gold and silver and the downward move in Bitcoin has something to do with there's inflation still. I mean, lending is creating this new M2, but there's also this industrial component.
Well, I mean, I'm looking here at the chart of...
You can't make anything with Bitcoin because it's, you know, it's ones and zeros. But you can make stuff with gold and silver.
Well, you can also look at your gold.
You can look at it. You can feel it, yeah.
Well, I'm saying here at 120,000, Russell, I think, said that the assets that they thought from wherever he was doing some research, total assets and all the total value... at that number of all the different, I won't say bitcoins, the different stuff was about $3 trillion. All right, so we're down to 87, so we're $2 trillion. So from the top, there's been a hit of $1 trillion in here. And you know what? It hasn't budged off this number since November, since it went down. It's showing no interest at all at running back up to that 120
number. Well, I think there's
120 number.
I think the horizontal move in it since then is probably the true believers in Bitcoin that are going to hold it no matter what.
Yeah.
Whereas the people that sold it, maybe they're moving into gold and silver because they're real speculators and they think there's going to be a huge demand for gold and silver coming forward.
Well, I think, as I was mentioning with Carl, even though you know this more than anybody, probably even including me, which I rarely say because it's what I studied when I was in school, it's still not in our vernacular. It's still not, when I look at even me who preaches this crap, I look at the price of my truck and I go, okay, I paid 10 for it, now I can't duplicate it 2 years later for 15.
Yeah.
My truck's up in value. No, it's not. No, it's not. Well, a little bit maybe because of the fact nobody can afford a new one.
That's the MT that's been created by all
this. That's what I'm saying. But none of us, U.S. of A. Americans, are saying, boy, I got this $10 bill in my pocket, and a month ago it was worth $10, now it's worth $9.50. Nobody thinks that way, but in fact, that's what's happened, right?
Yeah.
Not in terms of the currency.
You got all this lending. The banking rules are really skewed. I mean, why would you want to make loans? If you're a big bank, why would you want to make loans to businesses and whatnot when you can make it to non-financial banking institutions? And then have, you don't have to have as much capital on hand. And then on top of that, there's going to be this artificial demand for corporate debt, corporate bonds. If you make loans to small businesses and startups, you have to have 100% capital requirements. So there's this huge skew toward money, toward lending, toward credit that purchases financial assets, purchases real estate, purchases and causes these bubbles. So those changes were in effect since March of 2020?
Yeah.
When they redefined M1 to basically be M2. Right.
Well,
so I mean, that's where the lending is, and so lending. I mean, if you're making loans, you're creating money in that space, and you know, you look at C&I lending or consumer lending. You look at
margin loan. For God's sake, was huge. Yeah.
Margin loans are exploding, but yeah. C&I loans and consumer debt is flat for the last year, whereas the other ones aren't.
Well, you know, it's funny when you have you know, Kenny is absolutely terrific in his knowledge of the markets and everything. But he's a guy who's been in the market his whole life, and he's sort of a believer of a lot of what's happening. And he looks at these numbers. And he just said, you know, the unemployment rate's 4.4%, which is up a little bit, but it's fine. I mean, it's where the you look at.
I don't know if you can even trust unemployment numbers, because nowadays you have people who are you know, maybe they have a job and they're working some side gigs too. So, or maybe they're not in the labor market proper, but they're running some side gigs.
Yeah, when I was
I'm not sure how they would be counted in the unemployment rate.
I'm going to say I was in pre-med my freshman year, then I bailed over into economics, right? So I walk in and there's an older version of Hal Snarr teaching macroeconomics in the first day.
He's much shorter than me. He's probably, what, a foot shorter than me?
Oh, without a doubt. The first thing he said is, I don't know why people use this unemployment number. It's really a crack of shit.
It is, yeah.
So, and now here we are, how many friggin' years later, we have guys saying, well, look at the unemployment rate. I mean, what I'm saying is, here's the...
Well, I think maybe you can compare unemployment rates over time, but...
No, you can't.
You know, a lot of these statistics, you can't really take... I mean, you take them for a grain of salt when you look at them in terms of levels. I think the only way that you can use them is by comparing them through time. Well, it's like presidential polling.
If you went around...
I don't think the presidential polls mean much. The only thing that matters with the presidential poll, in my opinion, is it headed down or is it headed up? Because it's really hard
to
gauge that.
You can do a very good job at a presidential poll if you can get a random survey, but how do you do that?
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think it's really difficult. Then you got the blowback. I mean, you hear about the doctor in Florida who said he's not going to provide anesthesia to MAGA, and now the Florida is threatening to take away his license. I mean, you got these people in the silos.
Wait a minute, the MAGA guys are so tough they don't need it.
Yeah, I know, but all I'm saying is you have this like hatred between people. And And if you're MAGA and you believe the news media is, you know, progressive, and the people who are administering the polls are progressive, You're gonna. What are you gonna tell them? Are you gonna tell them the truth? Are you gonna tell them something to mess up their poll? You're probably gonna tell them to mess up their poll.
Well, listen to what's the one I once in a while just to keep it even. I listen to, was it Occupy Democrats or somebody on the right or on the left? These guys are idiots. And I turn on, I don't turn it on. I walk in and it's on TV at some places. Newsmax. I listen for 20 minutes and I'm ready to reach the air sickness back.
Yeah, yeah.
It's horrible. But just get back to the unemployment.
But people, I think most part, people will consume the media that reinforces their beliefs, and that causes siloing. And I don't think you get much growth personally, professionally, if you're that siloed. I think you have to have conversations with people you disagree with to actually grow as a person.
Well,
to grow up with knowledge.
You never learn anything from somebody who agrees with you.
I mean, it's like AI. AI, what does AI do? AI scrapes the internet.
Yeah.
So it's a really smart 12-year-old who has very little common sense, has no common sense, and believes everything it reads on the internet, right?
Well,
so even AI is siloed with Google search results.
Well, give me a minute just to go off on my rant here on this unemployment rate. The key in the unemployment, first, how many people will quote unemployment rate, and if you asked them, Hal, what exactly is it? How many people?
I don't think they understand how flawed it is. The labor force.
They even know what it is.
Yeah.
Well, for example,
the problem with the unemployment rate is, you know, I think back in 2008, the unemployment rate dropped 3 points, and conservatives were claiming that it was the government's statisticians who support the president, want to make them look good, and you know they doctored the report to make the unemployment rate fall. And I wrote an article about it, claiming, you know, well, you would need a lot of people to be in on that, and that's really hard to do. You know, you'd have to have a lot of liars working together. And then so people on the left were saying that, and then I was saying, well, you know, if the economy is rebounding, what happens when the economy rebounds is all of a sudden the unemployment rate just jumps up. When the economy's in recession and the unemployment rate jumps a couple points, spikes up, what does that mean? It means people are jumping back in the labor force, which is the divisor of the unemployment rate. They're jumping back in the labor force and they're looking for work because they hear things are good. So when people jump back in, the unemployment rate actually spikes upward.
That was the exact same definition a zillion years ago in that economics class. But I think that's...
And it's just math. The way they calculate the unemployment rate, the divisor is the labor force size.
It's not just math. It's how you pick up the numbers.
Well, I mean, when you calculate the unemployment rate, the divisor is the labor force. So if the labor force all of a sudden is increased by a million or two people because people hear that there are jobs and they start looking for work, then the unemployment rate will spike.
Okay, but the theory of it, you're absolutely correct. But I'm saying the theory of it, in the zillions of years it's gone since the first class and today, a lot of this stuff has changed.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the number, now right now the unemployment rate is 4.4, okay? Last December was 4.1. But in reality, last December, the definition of people unemployed are people that are not working, they're actively looking for a job. What percentage of the population even knows that definition, Al?
Probably not very many.
All right, but I'll take it from there. The first question should pop into the mind of any Stocks and Jacks listener, because you've been listening to me for so long. Okay, wait a minute. How do we figure out if somebody's actively looking or not? And therein lies the rub.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about, in December of last year, there were 6.9 million people allegedly not working and looking for a job. We got another 101 million people that aren't working that we don't think are looking for a job. Today, we have 7.5 million people that we think are wanting. The fact is, the number of people that aren't working has gone from 1079 to almost 111. That's the problem.
Yeah, well, I think the other problem is, you know, the surveying, they survey about, 60 to 80,000 households a month, the government does.
I,
and
I think
in the past they used landlines, but they're using cell phones,
you know,
today.
What?
So
I think a few years ago, Hal, and it's probably more of a Carl question, but I think they're cheating. I think if you get laid off, which I don't want to see you laid off, you get laid off and you go to the unemployment guy, and you get your, what is it, 6 months? The minute you drop off, they're not sending you a check. You're not considered looking for a job, even though you might actually be looking harder than you were a week before, because now you're not getting a check. And they will, as Carl would say, if they happen to call you because of the household survey and ask you that question and say, yeah, I'm looking for a job and I'm not working, you could conceivably get bumped back in. But in general, the minute
back
you...
Back into the survey?
It's in the household survey.
What you're saying is that people who are enrolled in unemployment are more likely to get a phone call from the government?
No. What I'm saying is once you drop off getting the check, they assume you're no longer looking.
Well, they ask you a question. They ask the person who answers the phone for the household, how many people in the household
I understand
are
that,
working?
I'm saying,
how many are looking for work?
I'm saying the cheat factor in there. Everybody who's getting a check, in theory, you're getting it because you're looking. You're supposed to report to them that you're actually looking for people. You're looking for a job. Yeah. The minute you fall off the check, you have to find your way back on another way. You know what I'm saying? They're using that number as like the cheat number.
Well, I'm not sure if they weave it in to the modeling. I'm not sure if they weave it in, but technically what they do is they just call 80,000 households every month and they ask them employment questions. In March, they ask them even more questions.
Right, what I'm trying to say is if you're on the unemployment roll,
you're
automatically in. Right?
So what you're saying is BLS uses actual enrollment numbers in their calculation of unemployment rate.
Sure, because if you're getting a check, by definition, you're looking, because you're telling them you're looking and they won't give you the check.
But I don't think they're merging the data from the unemployment offices into the BLS report.
I think it somehow gets in there. That's why when they increased the unemployment, when it was really bad, another 3 months or something, and then they dropped it back to 6, it went down a bunch because those people now weren't being counted. There's a mess in there, is what I'm saying. You know?
The whole idea of
splitting hairs like this, when you're talking about 110 million people and trying to figure out whether 100,000 of the 110 are really looking or not, and that's what changes the number. It's a pretty, you know, mathematically better than me, that's a very perilous game.
Well, but the BLS asked like questions like, how many people in the household are working? How many people aren't working who are looking for work? They ask them what their ages are. So you have to be 16 or older to be considered in the employment number.
Right.
You have to be, if you're not working, you have to be looking for work, or you have to be temporary furloughed. There's a lot of, but these are just questions they ask the person who answers the phone for the household. And I don't think maybe they seasonally adjust something with unemployment claims. I'm not sure. But the survey is, they literally ask these questions every month. How many people are working? How many people are not working? How many people are looking for work? How many people in the household are temporary furloughed and waiting for the call to go back to the factory? Those are the kinds of, and then they ask, if you're working for no pay, but you're working for a family-owned business, at least 15 hours a week, you're considered employed. If you're working for a wage, for at least 1 hour a week, you're considered employed. So they have really weak thresholds for being considered employed.
Mr. Math,
working an hour a week,
right? Mr. Math. My whole point is, there's 111 million people that aren't working. That's the number.
Yeah.
To try and pull some group out of there.
Well, here's the next question: of those 100 plus million people who aren't working, how many are doing these side gigs where they're making money on the side?
Well, okay, but
in various gigs.
But I mean, the point is the number is 111 million people. I know a chunk are students. I know a chunk are retired. But to try and pull out, have some mystical way of saying, out of the 110 million people, this month, 7.5 million are looking for a job. Oh, by the way, next month, only 7.4 are looking for a job. The rounding.
Have to rely on the honesty of the.
I'm saying the rounding there is so ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, I was at Walmart the other day, about a week ago, and this, and the lines were long, and this guy in front of me, he tells me, "Hey, you can follow me. I'm delivering the water. These two big things of water, pallets of water to this buyer." And I go, "What are you doing? You working for GitHub or something like that, or Grubhub or whatever it's called?" And you know, he said it was a new company. And then we had a conversation. I said, how much do you drive your car for this delivery? And he goes, I drive it like 80% of the time for delivery. And I go, well, you could probably, I'd go on Grok and ChatGPT and ask them questions about the tax implications, because you can deduct 80% of your gas bill, 80% of your car. He didn't even know this. So this kid is probably doing one or two of these side hustles. Is he included in the employment number? I don't, probably not.
Well,
but he's probably got a couple of these gigs going on.
The problem with the survey is
one, honesty. Who's gonna answer these questions honestly?
I'm having trouble getting this across. The number is 111.
I know. Yeah.
And to say that seven are looking versus eight, who cares?
Well, but that number depends on the respondent's answer, because the respondent will tell the government surveyor that the person is looking for work, or they're not looking for work if they don't have a job. And so they use that to separate the people who are unemployed, who are in the labor force and who are not in the labor force. So it's the respondent, it's the person responding to the person conducting the survey, one of thousands, is how they answer the question, is whether they get in the I'm in the labor force number, or I'm not but in the labor
the
force
key, the key number here, I'm trying to make a point. I'm doing a horrible job doing it. The key number is how many people are working.
Yeah.
What percentage? And that number is down to 59.7.
Yeah.
Of the people that are available to work.
Are you talking about the labor force participation rate or the employment to population?
And what I'm saying is that number, if it's 60.5 or 61, we're reasonably okay. If it gets down to 56 or 57, we got real problems. That's the number.
Oh, I know, yeah.
That's the number. Oh, but hey, I wanted to ask you, we got a couple minutes before break. Who are these guys, the Kiel Institute? Are you a sneaky member of the Kiel Institute?
Oh, I'm not, huh?
Well, the research team analyzed 25 million shipment records. These are about tariffs, covering a total value of almost $4 trillion. In U.S. imports, the findings are clear. U.S. customs revenue increased by $200 billion in 2025. Foreign exporters absorbed only about 4% of the tariff burden. 96% passed through to U.S. buyers. Trade volumes collapsed, but export prices did not fall. So they essentially are concluding it's the smaller the business, the more you're impacted, and you're less chance of passing it through. And oh, by the way, it's essentially a sales tax, which you and I have talked about for. But how many people on the MAGA side are absolutely convinced, because President never told the truth in his life, said the other guys are paying for it? Are we have a. Is everybody.
Every tax, there's going to be. They're going to share it. The seller of the product and the buyer of the product are going to share in the tax. That's true for every tax.
I understand
tax.
That, but.
Whether it's a corporate income tax, a payroll tax, or
you're,
a tariff.
You're shifting gears on me here. You're shifting gears. Yes. Yeah. On our side, out of the 96% that's paid for by U.S. people, some of it's going to be absorbed by the company and some the person, and it depends on the individual product. That part I get.
Yeah.
But the message from Washington was the foreign people are eating it. That's not happening.
Yeah. Well, I don't believe it. I mean, they're eating some of it.
4%.
They're eating some of it, but not all of it.
4%, according to these guys.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'd have to look in. I mean, what is the mission of this organization? I mean, are they?
That's why I asked you. Who are these guys? The Kiel Institute.
Yeah. Okay. I'd have to look into it, because I mean, you got to be really careful with what you read. It could be an organization that is populated with people that hate Trump, or it could be populated with people who love Trump. So you got to be really careful.
Well, we definitely don't want to read anything that the other side puts out. That part I get.
Yeah, I mean, you have to know the because everybody has a political bias. So if you don't like Trump and you don't like tariffs, you're gonna skew the report in a way that makes the tariffs look bad. If you love Trump and you like tariffs, you're gonna skew the report in a way that makes tariffs look not so bad. So I mean it's a data point, but you can't make judgments on policy based off of a couple of data points from an organization that I really don't know their slant.
Well,
and I do know that like any tax, a tariff is shared. It's going to be shared by foreigners and people here. Here, it's going to be shared by the sellers and the buyers.
The
percentage matters, right? And
Stop. Please. The part you're talking about, and I will agree with you, with the part that's missing from this, again, I thought you'd catch this, by the way.
Yeah.
The part that's missing is, did the person overseas drop their price to begin with?
Yeah.
And in so doing, somehow share. But that's not what they're talking about here. They're saying $200 billion worth of checks have been sent to the government. That's all on us. The foreigner never pays that. I think you would agree with me there.
Yep.
So they're saying that out of the $200 billion that have actually been paid, it's nothing more than a tax here. Now, whether the cost of the widget was $20 and came here at $19 because they absorbed a little bit, maybe. But that's not what they're counting. You understand where I'm coming from?
Well, I mean, the problem with the tariff discussion is you have to have a discussion about taxes in general, and we have to understand that when a tax is levied, and you levy it on a firm, the firm may not pay very much of it. It may be borne by the consumer in the form of higher prices. So when we have a discussion about tariffs, we have to have a discussion on taxes in general. I oppose taxes. I think the only tax we should have is a transaction tax tax.
So you don't want your policeman to get paid?
No, I'm not saying that.
Well, if you don't have taxes, how do you get paid?
Well, I mean, that's the argument that a supporter of the state always comes in with. You don't want a free market in healthcare because some snake oil salesman in 1880 sold something as medicine and it killed people.
No, it had a lot of alcohol in it. Probably was good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I probably enjoy the snake oil salesman's product, but it's not going to help me health-wise. So,
Al, you do realize that of all the cures of colds that don't work, alcohol is by far the most popular.
Well, I've read something about fermented garlic that the Amish store in their underground cellars for 750 days.
Well, garlic's got medicinal properties.
The health benefits from that are pretty incredible.
Well, we got to go to break here, but now my friend Fran, who's long deceased, she was one of our waitresses over at the Series, where you were, and she would prescribe the cure, because of course in the trading floor you could have quadruple pneumonia and be hacking like there's no problem, and you were right into the pit every day because you paid for your lease, right?
Yeah.
So in the wintertime, if there was a germ anywhere, you got it. I mean, you're talking about 350 people in my pit lived one where you're basically behind elbow with the guy next to you, and they're coughing like right in your ear. But the cure, and now tell me, this is somewhat medicinal. Hot tea, fresh squeezed half a lemon, big tablespoon of honey, and a big shot of booze. It works. That was the cure.
Well, the big shot of booze will make you feel better, that's for sure.
The other stuff's actually pretty medicinal, right?
Healthy or not, that's the question, but it'll make you feel better.
Well, the lemon and the honey are pretty good. I mean, they'll help a little bit.
Yeah, but it depends on the alcohol content of the booze, right?
Well, they used to use...
If that alcohol content's enough, you don't care if you're sick or not.
Well, you know the junk they used to use? Remember that?
So it feels like a cure.
Do they even make this anymore? They used to use rock and rye.
And then if the doctor prescribes it every 5 hours, man, you're going to be feeling pretty good.
Remember rock and rye? You ever see that booze?
What's that?
Rock and rye.
Rock and Ryan?
Rock and rye was the name of the booze.
Oh, I don't know.
It actually had a shrunk orange.
Tom, I am a guy that should never, ever take part of booze because Man, I'll tell you, my nickname in the Navy was Two Beers. If I have two beers, my toes curl, and I may be blacked out, but functional. So I'm, I don't know anything about booze.
Anyway,
I touch it, and I'm not.
I never tried this stuff, but it actually had a shrunken orange in the bottle. How they got it in there, I don't know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, anyway, S&P futures up 15. NASDAQ futures up 148. Be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Blowing up by Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Al. Ricky on the board. SP futures up 15. We're up yesterday. We're trying to be up again today. NASDAQ futures up 146. Dow futures down 269. Now, the reason for that is United Healthcare, you know, it's bounced back a little bit. Still down $53. So that's $350 like right there, because the multiplier. We got Goldman Sachs down 3, we've got Boeing down 3, we got Apple up 4, Amazon up 1, and I think we got Nvidia up a little bit. Nvidia's up 58 cents. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 6, call that flat. FTSE up 53.5%, CAC round up 36.5%. So European stocks rise after EU's mother of all deals with India. It's only like 2025 or 26. We got 74 years of the. How many more deals in a century you can have already? Only quarter of the way through. Over in Asia, Nikkei up 448.8%. Hang Seng up 361, 1.3%. Shanghai up 7, call that flat. South Korea's Hotsby hits fresh record as Trump levels tariff threats against Seoul. God, this is just crazy world. Oil up 37 cents, 61, finally a little bit above the 60 number. Brent up 34 cents, 65.93. Natural gas came off a little bit today on 21 cents, 6.58, still really high. Everybody's bills are going to be pretty high with this cold weather. Gold down 30 cents, 5,082. Silver down 3.50. It's 112 on silver. That's really some. I don't even say. FX, dollar struggles to rebound as Fed meeting comes into focus. It's still... The euro is 119. It's as high as we've seen it in a long time. And the pound's 137. So the dollar is basically its ass kick. Crypto, up 142, 87,801. When I say crypto, I mean Bitcoin. Ricky, what do you have for us? Traffic, weather, sports? Not much sports.
Hey, good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:36 a.m. here in Chicago. We're looking at 14 degrees right now with a high of 14. Intervals of clouds and sunshine. Breezy and frigid all day with blowing and drifting snow. Tonight will be clear to partly cloudy and remaining frigid with a low of 3 degrees Fahrenheit. Phoenix, Arizona, 46 degrees right now with a high of 72. Nice with intervals of clouds and sun as well. And tonight will be clear and cool with a low of 45 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, there's pretty heavy traffic all around. It's kind of been a mess all day. Today. Multiple delays on Kennedy. First off, there's an accident on the right shoulder westbound at Foster Avenue. Another accident westbound on Kennedy at Diversey Avenue. Completely congested Kennedy. Additionally, we have an accident on the left shoulder northbound on Edens at Niles Center Road. Stop and go traffic on Eisenhower from Des Plaines to Laramie Avenue due to the accident earlier this morning. There's another accident on the right shoulder northbound on Stevenson on Harlem Avenue. And no accidents on Den Ryan yet, but prepare for some medium traffic inbound. Be really, really safe out there. It's kind of crazy today. Sports real quick. Patriots beat Broncos 10-7 and Seahawks beat Rams 31-27, which means that Patriots and Seahawks face off February 8th at the Super Bowl. For the NHL, the Blackhawks play Wild today at 7 p.m. And finally, the NBA. Yesterday, the Bulls lost to Lakers 118-139. And today, we got the Nets visiting Suns at 8 p.m. Back over to you guys.
The it's interesting stuff as usual going on here. What do you make of a question for you, Ricky? Are there people? I mean, I don't keep track of this too much. There are companies that were demanding people come back to work at the start of the year or something, because the traffic is all of a sudden more in the morning. I was talking to the guy who owns the lots around here, and he said all of a sudden they got a lot more business. Is there a demand for people coming back to work at the start of the year?
Demand? Yeah, I guess I would say so. I mean, I've been trying to find another job, an extra job, and it's kind of been hard. So I don't know how many people are there actually looking, but it might just be like the industries I'm looking for too, you know. All these office jobs and all that, I'm sure they just like do business as usual, you know.
Yeah, because it was pretty crowded this morning on the expressway, considering how lousy the weather is.
Yeah, and it's kind of messy out there, you know. Yeah. So everybody really be safe out there, because there's a whole bunch of accidents, you know. I don't know what's going on today.
Yeah, did you guys dodge this weather bullet or no?
Oh, no. It feels like Wyoming and North Carolina. It's like 15 degrees last night. You can't even go outside.
Do you guys have a furnace?
We have a natural gas furnace.
I don't imagine your insulation and all that stuff's the same as here.
Yeah, the windows, I mean, you can feel the cold.
You guys probably, the air conditioning work the same way, I suppose.
Well, but we have the central air, you know, air conditioning.
Do you have a snow shovel?
You know, none of my neighbors and I have snow shovels. I was out there yesterday with a rake, trying to rake the snow off the driveway.
How'd that work out?
I can't go to Lowe's and buy a snow shovel, because I'll buy it and I will not use it for another 5 years. Well, if I knew I was going to use it every year, I'd buy a snow shovel. Well, but
buy one that you can use like for something else, maybe, you know.
What's that?
You could possibly use it for something else, you know.
But in our HOA neighborhood, the HOA takes care of the lawn, so I don't have to really dig anything up.
So you're worried about the $20?
I just can't buy a snow shovel if I'm going to use it once, like over the next day when hopefully the sun will melt the snow. But I can't go out and buy a snow shovel if I'm going to use it once over the next 5 years. Can't do it. It's got to have more use than that, man.
My uncle used to say, if you like the guy, he's careful. If you don't, he's cheap.
I'm not cheap. I'm frugal. I will pick up the check when I'm with my buddies. My brother Ryan, though, it was funny. It's not the case now, but like 20 years ago, if I went to dinner with Ryan and Rod and Todd and a couple of my Navy buddies, when the check would come, Ryan would like sneak into the bathroom.
You know, he doesn't
do that now. But
so assuming you talk to your neighbors, I have a suggestion.
Yeah.
Why don't you each throw $5 in? Go get one snow shovel, and at the end, raffle it off to when the winner gets the snow shovel to keep.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm kind of like, there's a scene in Wings TV show where Joe and his wife, Helen, move into a beach house, and Brian's living with them, and the neighbors are all friendly, and Joe and Helen want to become friends with the neighbor, and Brian's only way that you should greet a neighbor is by doing this, and then he kind of grunted hello.
I thought he was gonna say make some cookies and bring them over.
That's kind of how I am, you know. In the South, when you get a little too friendly with people in the South, it's like when you become friends, when you come home from work, they tend to be on your yard with a beer in their hand, and they want to drink beer with you in the afternoon.
Well, it could get worse.
There's a movie about people in Atlanta. It's a comedy about couples and whatnot. And this is definitely the case in Atlanta, where you sit around the neighborhood lawns with your neighbors and you drink in the afternoon. And I have no desire to do that. If I get, like I said, was early in the previous segment, if I have more than two beers, I might be blacked out. I just don't metabolize alcohol very well at all. And I can't get drunk, because then I can't do my work. I can't function. So I try to stay away from it. Not that I don't like it. I mean, I do like a good beer, like an oatmeal stout or porter, but it'll be like once every 6 months where I'll even try a beer or even sip a beer. I'll get usually about halfway through it, because I just love my work so much and I can't.
What's the current research? I know you're doing this macro class.
Well,
are you getting
the stuff on the interest rates? Yeah, I'm working on this research where I'm looking at the opportunity zones in the 2007 tax reforms. And we're looking at employers, firms who were kind of like beneficiaries. There's a couple of NAICS codes where we can use a couple of NAICS codes where they were kind of like the beneficiaries of these opportunity zones. And we're looking at the growth rate in those numbers of firms at different numbers of employees, different sizes of employers over time, to see if there's any impact of the opportunity zones. Kind of like my Startup New York. It's a take on my Startup New York research. The next thing I want to do is I had this discussion on Facebook with my brother, who's turned into a pretty good amateur economist. We had this discussion on the minimum wage, because in Washington State, they raised it to like, I don't know, $16 an hour, something like that. And I thought, well, you know, in Assotin, Washington, which is Clarkston, Washington, which is the community my brothers live in, Lewiston, Idaho, Clarkston, Washington, the low-skilled market wage is probably around $12 to $13 an hour. But in Seattle or Tacoma, it's probably around $20. So if you come in with a statewide minimum wage of, I don't know, $18, it's non-binding in an urban center, but it's binding in a rural community like Assotin County. So what does that do? Well, it probably has a negative impact on employers who hire low-skilled labor in Assotin County, but probably has no impact on employers in Tacoma or SeaTac area. And if I don't know if you know this, but there was a Republican on Long Island who supported a national minimum wage in the 1960s. And he just so happened to support a minimum wage that was probably non-binding in New York, Long Island area, but it was in Alabama. And I think he supported it for reasons obvious, right? Want to help the poor. But when you put it at that level, what you're trying to do is you're trying to stem the flow of employers leaving New York and Long Island and going to places like Alabama where the wages are lower. So my next research is going to be looking at that, and I'm hoping to present it at Auburn University. I think the conference is in March or April this year. So I submitted an abstract to do that research, which I haven't done yet, which means I got a fire under myself to get this work done so I can present it. That's how I think a lot of research gets done. You submit an abstract without doing it yet, and then you got this deadline and you got to get it done. So that's my next level of research.
Sort of like a term paper.
Yeah, and then it's hopefully go into an academic publication. And then my third area of research that I want to do this year is looking at employment and employers in the industry code, professional, scientific, and technical areas. There's NAICS codes for it. There's employment data for it. And then look at how employment or number of employers has changed relative to a baseline, you know, all employees or all employers over time, and then have a break point in December of 2022. I think that's when ChatGPT rolled out. What year was it? 2022, 2024?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. I want to see if there was no difference before, if that difference now is like accelerating. Because the ChatGPT, you hear stories about how firms are letting all these people go, and they're not hiring young people like my brother-in-law Chris because they have one or two guys managing an office or a team that once had maybe 10 to 20 people. They're having one guy do the work of 20 people, and they're basically managing an AI. So I want to look at that. So that's on my research agenda for the next 6 months.
No matter where you look at the minimum wage, I mean, I'm sure there's never a class anymore in this, but I actually have a full semester of labor economics.
Oh, yeah, I teach labor.
And it's the classical stuff or your new stuff?
Well, the labor class I teach, it has a lot of different topics, but the favorite discussion we have in class is about discrimination. I work at a historically black college university, and discrimination in the labor market, employer discrimination, statistical discrimination, employee discrimination, and customer discrimination, those four things are usually the most popular topic in the class.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. When you look at labor theory, if you actually, you know, spend some time to study it, it's very similar to just regular economics. I mean,
you have a demand. But the difference is, what is being supplied and what is being demanded in a product market versus a labor market? When a labor market, you're supplying yourself. You're not supplying a widget. You're not supplying a cup. You're not supplying a remote.
Well, you're a factor of production like everything else.
Yeah. Yeah, so in labor markets, it's not about products being supplied and purchased, right? It's about people being demanded and supplied. So there's an additional layer of it, right? And people, unlike like a phone or a book or a Lego, people have to make sink or swim decisions every day of their life. People are constantly making sink or swim decisions. A stick doesn't make a sink or swim decision. A stone doesn't make a sink or swim decision. And that's the problem with macroeconomics. Macroeconomics kind of is like planetary dynamics, where you know you apply a tax cut or an increase in government spending to see how that blob, the consumer, responds to it. And the problem with that aggregation is some are going to respond positively to it, some are going to respond negatively to it. And then in the aggregate, the positive and the negative gets washed away in the aggregate. So it's like, you know, you got an asteroid coming toward the Earth. We need to park a spaceship near that asteroid to use the gravity of the spaceship to pull that asteroid off a trajectory of hitting the Earth. That's kind of how macroeconomics works. But at the individual level in labor economics, you have real people with kids. And that's what makes it really fascinating, in my opinion, is that you got to bring in this idea that everybody is different. And so the way I teach labor is that on a labor supply curve, each of us has different reservation wages. And when you put them together in a labor market, that relationship between the reservation wage and whether you're going to work that full-time job or not is what populates the labor supply curve. And then on the labor demand curve, you have something similar. Like, you know, you have this employee that with high skill level that you can ascertain from their application, their job history and whatnot, their letters of recommendation, you value them the most. But then you got this guy with no experience and you value that person the least, and you can put them on a continuum, and we call that labor demand. So in labor economics, it's more realistic and it comes to life more than a simple product market.
Well, it's a kind of totally different, or I guess maybe an evolution, the way I learned it. And
yeah, well, you probably learned the neoclassical, where you know all workers are homogeneous, and when you assume the workers are homogeneous, and you institute a policy like minimum wage, you know the people who are harmed are nameless and faceless. But when you model them in a more realistic way, where I have a reservation wage of say 10, and that guy, because he has two more kids, has a reservation of eight. Well, when the minimum wage is instituted and say it's at 9, I'm no longer going to work because my reservation wage is 10, his is 8. He's going to work. I'm kicked out of the labor market. I'm the marginal worker. So the way I teach it, it puts names and faces to the people who are demanding labor and the people who are supplying labor.
Well, you may be doing that, but you're also, it sounds like, and this is not a critique, by the way, I'm just saying it's different. It sounds like you're taking a lot of what exists and saying that's the way things ought to be. Now, when I learned it...
Yeah, what I'm doing is I'm taking neoclassical models and I'm interpreting them with Austrian
principles. Well, I don't know what neoclassical means, but...
Well, neoclassical is the traditional way that labor is taught. And I like neoclassical models, but I interpret them from an Austrian school.
But you're not. But nowhere in this conversation have you mentioned the thing that was absolutely on top of the agenda when I learned it. What does the person do for you?
Yeah.
So the idea, boy, it's going to sound so bizarre to people, is you sit there and you go, all right, I got all this paint, I got all these brushes, I got people who want their house painted. I'm going to hire a painter. And I'm going to pay him $10 an hour. Okay, at the end of the day, I paid him $100, and I made $800. So this guy was worth essentially 700 hours to me. So you go.
Well, that's the maximum we're willing to pay for that labor. That's
no,
the labor
no. Actually, it's not. When now you sit there and go, now if I had two guys and paid him a little more. Now what happens? Now we can do a job and a half. We're not going to do double the job, but the point is, you ended up paying the last person you paid exactly what he was worth to you.
Yeah,
there's the
Tom, that last worker where you're paying them what they're worth to you, that is the maximum you're willing to pay
right.
for that last employee. That's the labor demand curve.
What do they call it? It's the maximum something. But the
maximum willingness to pay or ability to pay.
But if you ask people now about the value, like if you went to Walmart, I had a show from Walmart, and I said, what do you guys pay the people in your tire department? You know, oh, yeah, we pay them a lot, $20 an hour. Okay. I guarantee you, put me in your tire department. After I get in shape, standing up again for all day long, I'm gonna bet you that the value, if you're doing 5,000 hours a day in tires, I'll guarantee you, 2 months after, with somebody else doing the show with me, 2 months after the two of us are there, you're gonna be doing 8,000 a day. What happens to us? Well, what do you mean? I said, well, okay, we just brought 3,000 a day to you. What do we get? Well, you're getting $20 an hour. No. That's not where I'm going with this. The man had no idea what I was talking about. That labor makes money for you. And there's some connection between what they do for you and what you pay them. He had no idea what I was talking about.
Well, in that particular labor market, you're essentially paying a wage high enough to maintain your workforce so you can
maintain effective production. Some people, if a guy walks in and wakes him up and says, I want to buy tires, somebody else is going to walk in and they're getting their oil changed, and I go, boy, you know, you got a bump tire here. I'm not going to lie to anybody. I'm saying, if I can increase sales, what does that do for my salary? And the answer was nothing.
Yeah.
Well, what's the point of that?
Yeah, see, the issue with that is it's kind of like the – what's going on there is he can hire – he's kind of assuming that workers are homogeneous.
Which they're not.
What they're not. Exactly. Well,
plus,
not.
As they learn something, they might actually get better. If they had the incentive, they might help you out a little bit.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. And but what's going on there is if you're a really productive worker and you're bringing in all kinds of business because people want you to work on their car, if the owner of the shop doesn't recognize that and pay you more, then that owner of that shop loses you. And what you do is you go off and you start your own mechanic shop.
Well, I get that. What I'm saying is a lot of today's labor economics
have nothing. Owner or the manager to keep that kind of talent. And you see it at McDonald's all the time. At McDonald's, you can go into McDonald's and one guy is, he's working the window, he's working a cash register, he's, you know, running the register, he doesn't have to look at it anymore. He can roll up orders left and right. You have the new guy who can't take the pickle off the Big Mac, right? And he has to ask the person that's very productive to pull the pickle off his order so he can give that customer their meal, right? Well, what do you got against pickles? He's going to go off and find a job where he's going to get value. So McDonald's ends up with a group of people who, you know, are they can do the work, but they're not going to have that productivity. Productivity guy is going to eventually maybe go to college or start his own business or her business.
What I'm going with here is that I'm trying to make the, again, clumsily, is that in classic labor economics, what I learned is there's constantly a connection between what the person is getting paid or what the person's willing to pay based on how much money the worker is worth to him. I'm saying that connection, nobody even...
Well, it's still there.
It's there, and you know it's there, but I'm saying people don't... What do you mean?
In reality, people have no connection. They don't understand that.
No, and yet, if everything was back to being a small group, and I, you know, well, you were on a farm. If I hire a guy to help me with the farm, and all of a sudden, I've got, you know, 60 gallons of milk going today to the market versus 30, the guy's worth 30 gallons of milk to me. Now, I can't pay him the entire amount, or else.
Well, I think what happens there is psychology. The owner of the farm, he will or she will think that increased productivity is a result of something he or she did, and not the worker.
Well,
and so if they fail to recognize that the worker is responsible for the increased productivity, then they'll lose that worker, and they'll have to hire somebody else. And maybe over time they learn that lesson. But that person who's not paid their full worth, who realizes they're not being paid their full worth, they'll go somewhere else. Now, a lot of people will underestimate their value. A lot of people underestimate their value, and they stick with an employer even though they're not paying what they're worth.
If we don't think in terms of what is somebody doing for me, how much is he worth to me, this whole idea, well, here's our wage rate, and people are like this mouse on my machine, they're all the same. No, they're not.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, workers
are not the same. There are high productivity workers and low productivity workers.
Now, what would you say if I said maybe in your area there might be a guy, says maybe if the kids aren't going to school, they might go out and buy 10 snow shovels and put the kids to work, and he might actually make $5,000 a day and be able to donate the snow shovels.
Well, if somebody comes up and says, "Hey, I got a snow shovel, can I shovel your driveway?" I'll ask him how much they're going to charge me, and if he says $5, I'll go, "Yeah, I'll give you $5." But if they're going to charge me $20, I'll say no, because I can go get a shovel
What if he takes a picture of you with the rake and sends it to your students? I'd love to.
Well, I'll just respond.
Let's put it this way, Ricky, if he sent it here, what would we do with it? We'd immediately put it out, would we? I would love to see that picture.
Well, I would just say, you know, it's not worth it to buy a shovel because I don't expect to use it next year or the following year or in 3 years. I maybe might expect to use it in 10 years. So I would just laugh.
Well, you know,
and you know, the rake did work because the snow that I did rake, I broke it up enough where the sun got into it and melted it.
Oh, God. Well, you know, this actually does happen. When I was, we got a dash here in a minute, but when I was working with Pullman on the transit order for Boston, they had some incredible storm. This is 78. They had some incredible storm like 5 years before, and it was, you know, it was a real big deal. The massive nor'easter, right? They had so much snow. They had everything. Even the trains couldn't run, which is pretty, you know, usually the trains can run pretty much because there's a little plow like on the front of all the cars.
Oh, yeah, it knocks the snow right off.
Well, but there was so much snow, they couldn't go anywhere, right?
Yeah, the snow on the side of the tracks was so large that they couldn't push any more snow into the piles.
Well, so they decided they're gonna go out and buy this snow eater.
Yeah.
Where you push it in front of the locomotive, and it there's a big, you know, fan in there, and shoves the snow into the back of this basically big hopper car. And the hopper car was being heated by natural gas or something, or propane. We essentially melted the snow and poured the water off on the side of the tracks.
Oh, wow.
So they use it, but of course, by the time they get it, the snow is gone, right? But now they're prepared. Well, now I entered a picture. I showed up with these idiots. 5 years later, the thing cost at that time the incredible number of like $350,000. This is like 1972.
And, wow.
So that's
a couple million now, huh?
Well, then they had never used it. The thing had rusted so bad they scrapped it. They never want to use it.
That's
so,
my problem, Tom. See, if I
that
buy
would be
a shovel.
Only you're talking $20 instead of... Anyway.
I can use a shovel.
Got it. SP Futures up 15. NASDAQ Futures up 140.
I can use a rake, though.
Oh, God. Hal, you're the best, buddy. Ricky, have you ever heard anybody quite like Hal?
No.
No. That was
I'm a one in a million. Ask my wife. She loves.
We'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jacks.
Loves.
That's all, folks.